This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I want to start with just a couple of numbers. Elise Glink will join us out of the gate from ThinkLink Media and Best Money Moves. Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you, John?
Good. Some smart person on this show. It wasn't you, although I would put you in the company of the smart people. But somebody suggested that the elections go as does the market, or do the markets, the last 3 months before an election. So we looked it up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average 3 months ago today was at 38.7. Today it's at 41.8. The NASDAQ was at 16.2. Now it's at 18.1. The S&P was at 51, and now it's at 5,700, which would then predict, if you believe all of that, that the incumbent stays in office. You don't do a sea change when the markets are doing that well the 3 months before the election. There's so many other factors this time that I guess that might not be definitive. We will see. But then there you were trotting around with this "What does Warren Buffett know that we don't" article, and I wondered what you were thinking about that.
Well, you know, it's interesting, John. I think that in a typical year, if we ever really have one anymore, typical election year, you would take a look at the economy and you would take a look at the incumbent and say, well, they've obviously done something right over the last 4 years. We have a very strong economy. It's the envy of the world. Stock market is up a crazy amount, even year over year. I mean, just year to date, the Dow is up 11%, but a year over year, almost 23%. And then I saw this story about, you know, Warren Buffett, who has been selling and has piles and piles of cash. He now has more cash than even Elon Musk is worth. He has Berkshire Hathaway, which is his company, has $300 billion in cash. And the company has been selling. Mostly what they've been selling is Apple and Bank of America. And they dumped a quarter of their gigantic Apple stake in the third quarter of this year. And that was the fourth consecutive quarter that he had been selling. And it's sort of interesting to kind of look at it. It makes you wonder, does he think that there's going to be an incredible buying opportunity coming up? Meaning, you know, with that much cash, you could buy, I don't know, half the world maybe. But seriously, does he think that the stock market's going to take a big drop and so things will be cheap? It was interesting to just kind of think about that.
Right. So with all of that cash, it may be that he thinks those companies aren't going to do well. If those companies aren't going to do well, then a lot of companies aren't going to do well. Or maybe he's siphoning cash off because he thinks some other sector or sectors are going to profit, and he's going to move the money into those new areas.
Right. And we have been seeing some movement, which is interesting. NVIDIA replaced Intel in the Dow 30 today. I think it was today or yesterday, which is kind of interesting as you think about growth of companies. NVIDIA is up, I don't even know how many thousand percent in the last 5 years. It's done very, very well. But maybe there are other companies that Warren Buffett's team have their eye on, and they're just waiting for, they're taking some profits. They've had a lot of profits in Apple. They've had a fair amount of profits from Bank of America. They profited by more than $10 billion just by offloading the Bank of America investment. So maybe they see another area of tremendous growth. Maybe they are looking to, I know it's not the crypto thing, it's not Warren Buffett's style, but I could imagine him making some big investments in AI, artificial intelligence, and companies related to that.
Talking to Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and now about first-time home buyers. I'm surprised at the percentage of people. Is it first-time home buyers that we're talking about, Elise?
Yeah, it is. So first-time home buyers have decreased to the smallest number in history. The smallest number of buyers are first-time buyers, just 24% market share. That's down from 32% last year and half of what it was in 2010. This is the lowest number since the realtors started collecting data in 1981. And it's a concern because, of course, young people really want to buy a home. Now, the other part of that is that you are a lot older now when you're buying a home than you were 30 years ago. So the median first-time homebuyer age increased to 38 right now, 38 years old. Last year, it was 35. And 30 years ago, it was 26 or 27, I think. So that increase has a lot to do with the cost of homes. the rise in mortgage interest rates and simply the fact that people are having to spend a lot longer time saving up for their down payment.
Yeah, well, you answered my next question. Although I wonder, too, if that's by choice. I wonder how many people are simply choosing not to buy a home when they could because either they're transient, they're mobile, they're moving around, they want to travel, they want to spend their money in other ways. I don't know. I'm just trying to turn that over and see if there's a more nuanced explanation for that.
I think it's really that people are having trouble affording a home and finding the kind of home they want to buy. The typical repeat buyer age increased to 61 years old from 58. And the average age of a home seller, also the oldest, I think, ever in history, is now 63, the average age of a person selling a home. And when we say average or median, right, it's the middle. The idea that you've got people obviously much older than that who are selling and much younger than that, of course, but you know, this idea that we're time shifting everything a little bit later in life, right?
Well, and that's why I think why I asked that question, because some young people are choosing to get married later, have kids later. And it's that was a choice. They could have gotten married younger. They could have had kids and started their families younger. They are consciously making those decisions for a variety of reasons. And I don't think all of them are economic, although I'm not ignoring the elephant in the room. You also said 26% of buyers pay in cash for their homes. And
So
I can't imagine that.
Well, this is people who sell their homes. They've lived in them a long time. They've paid off their mortgage. Now they have cash to buy. You're also seeing hedge funds and private equity groups come in, and they are buying homes for cash, holding on to them and keeping them intact. So there's a lot of different reasons why people might have the cash. I suppose a few people have won big lotteries as well, but I think they're few and far between.
Talk about homeowners insurance these days.
Well, this was kind of an interesting study. It looked at the differences between who is paying more, red states or blue states. This comes to us from LendingTree. And they were looking at homeowners insurance and auto insurance. And so what they found is that the average homeowners insurance, the cost in a red state, or a state that primarily votes for the Republicans, is $909 higher than in swing states and $1,200 higher than in blue states. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And then if you look at average auto insurance costs, you pay $260 more in blue states and $466 more. I'm sorry, swing states pay more than blue states by $260 and $466 more than red states, which is fascinating. And so when you look at these costs by state, you have to ask yourself, well, why is that happening? The red state thing is sort of interesting. So the red states on the southeast coast have been hit very hard over the last couple of years with increased flooding. And what we see is that the costs of cars to replace a car, the average cost of a car is now $45,000. So to replace that car is extremely expensive. And when you have a huge flood like we saw this year in Asheville, for example, or in Florida with the hurricanes, you know, you might have two or three cars per family. An insurance company is replacing all of those in many cases. It's a significant amount of money. And so the costs for that are rising. But you're seeing flooding at other places as well. And the costs do get spread out for national insurance companies across the country. Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting to see, you know, the red and the blue, I guess, mostly because the election's tomorrow.
9 of the 10 states with the highest annual average home insurance rates lean red. 3 red states, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Kansas, lead, with the highest ranking blue state is Colorado in 6th. I presume the other red-leaning states that have the highest annual average home insurance are Florida, Louisiana, North and South Carolina, Texas. Those all lean red. But that makes sense because of the weather. California, I would imagine, would be on that list, though, too, for high, right? Wouldn't you suggest that or suspect that?
Yeah, I think California is certainly jumping up. And the thing that makes California dangerous, there are a couple of things. One are mudslides and the other one are
fires,
yeah. Right? There are some limitations that homeowners insurance policies are putting around specific types of catastrophes. And I would encourage everybody to start taking a look, a deeper, closer look at their new insurance policies as they come out. Because these, you know, the lines that insurance companies are drawing around these things might have different kinds of deductibles for different specific events, like a fire. Or if you may not get the kind of protection you think you're getting if you don't take these six steps to prevent the fires, right? And so there's some things that are specifically going on in California but are, you know, now filtering around to the rest of the country that bear witness. But the thing in California that has long been the most expensive is earthquake insurance. That was carved out a long time ago. And so if you have a damage caused by an earthquake, your regular homeowner's insurance policy won't cover it. And for many cases, including flood insurance and, you know, flooding, that's already been carved out. So you got to read your policies very carefully.
Elise Glink, owner of ThinkLink Media. Click on thinklink.com. Thank you, Elise.
Always a pleasure, John.
Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Welcome back, Jim. And I'm talking about TechNexus expanding co-working space. What's the story here?
Hey, John, that's right. So, you know, at TechNexus, you know, we've grown into one of the most active startup investors in the Midwest with about 200 startup investments over the last 7 years. But the other part of our business is actually the thing that we were first known for, which you mentioned, which is co-working. You know, we launched back in 2007 as Chicago's first tech hub and co-working space for startups. And earlier this year, we really significantly grew our space in the Civic Opera building in a multi-floor expansion. TechNexus, we now have 100,000-plus square feet of co-working space, suites, and offices, what we call Teamworking by TechNexus, which is the name of our co-working space. That's now making us the single largest co-working space in the city of Chicago. So some significant expansion news for us there, which really just gives us, you know, more space to kind of be the place for scaling startups in Chicago. So not more than 80 companies in Chicago currently call Teamworking home, where they use us to grow with them as they grow. So companies can start at Teamworking with, you know, one or two folks, and then as they grow their revenue, maybe they bring in some funding, they can add an office of 5 or 10 or 20 and beyond. And so that's really kind of the bread and butter for Teamworking, is really providing a space to scale as companies grow.
How do you gauge your success or chart your company's success? That is it occupancy per square foot? or if you've got 100,000 square feet, how many people can you accommodate then?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on how the companies themselves decide to grow. I mean, we've got the ability for a company to scale, you know, an office in our space to up to 50 or more people, right? And so it's not necessarily like how many different companies it is as much as it is, you know, providing the opportunity for companies themselves on a one-to-one basis to continue to grow. And so, you know, what we measure is, you know, continued growth and interest in our space. And that's something that we're seeing. It's interesting, you know, the downtown commercial real estate market. I mean, so much of this industry is still in flux, is still in turmoil. But one thing that we're really seeing is, you know, companies are valuing flexible office space. I think for so many businesses, the 5 day a week return to office is just never going to happen. And, you know, what we're seeing is that companies really value kind of flexible space that one can grow with them, but also allow their employees to come in 2 days a week, 3 days a week. And you don't maybe necessarily need the traditional office space that you did, you know,
right,
5, 10 years ago.
Right. Yeah. But so I'm just trying to get my head around that space. It sounds like you're not an incubator necessarily, at least not for everybody, but is it also the place where somebody's just striking out and it's them by themselves and they need a phone and a desk and a meeting space? I mean, who are your clients in that area?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a lot of solo desks, right? So people can come in and kind of be a solo entrepreneur and kind of get started at Teamworking by TechNexus, right? So you can be, you know, somebody working by yourself, you jump into a phone booth, you got access to internet, you got the coffee machine, you got the soda machine, you've got everything you kind of need as a sort of a one-man band. And then, hey, maybe eventually in a year from now, you need a five-person desk, and that's kind of the clientele that we go with there. And so certainly, you know, one thing that we at Teamwork Inc. and by TechNexus really value is community, right? So this is a space full of entrepreneurs. And so the idea is that, you know, you could be working on your business and run into someone else who's, you know, got a similar business or something that they're working on. So that community aspect is a big piece of it.
Well, I guess you guys have a pretty confident view of where hybrid work is going to go then, right?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's certainly what we're seeing. And companies really kind of value the ability to have that flexible space. And what we're seeing, too, is, you know, a lot of companies will, you know, be headquartered maybe in the suburbs or, you know, kind of downstate and want sort of a downtown satellite office. So kind of some physical office space where they can bring employees, you know, every now and then, or kind of bring employees for kind of an on-site later on. And so, you know, maybe a company isn't necessarily headquartered in downtown Chicago, but hey, they want to have some satellite office space to collect employees during certain points of the year.
Let's talk about Prenosis AI. Here again, did I pronounce that right? And tell me this story.
Yeah, Prenosis AI, local Chicago med tech startup. Some nice news from them. They were recently named to Time Magazine as one of the best inventions of 2024. And they're really all about sepsis diagnosis. So sepsis is one of the leading causes of death in U.S. hospitals, affects about 1.7 million people each year. And really, time is of the essence when diagnosing sepsis, right? Doctors have historically not had a really reliable way to do that and quickly enough to save patients with antibiotics. And so just earlier this year, the Food and Drug Administration authorized Prenosis sepsis immunoscore technology, which is an AI diagnostic test for sepsis. So it helps doctors quickly diagnose infections and actually predict when patients are most likely to progress quickly when it comes to sepsis. So some really interesting medical technology here from a Chicago startup, and a nice little nod in this Time recognition of the best inventions of the year.
It sort of reminds me of the fact that a lot of this data is out there, has been out there. AI isn't generating necessarily the new data, but it's able to analyze it, isn't it? It's able to interpret it. I mean, give it to a doctor and say, here's what AI thinks might happen or might be happening, what you should do. That's the hook, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And so their test is built on an AI algorithm that scans over 20 different health metrics. So your vital signs, your cell, blood measurements, to basically come up with a sepsis risk score. And so based on that score, doctors can have more confidence in kind of how they treat the patients and knowing which patients are at high risk.
Keep doing what you're doing over there. That's a nice report from TechNexus Venture Collaborative. That's Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications. Let's talk next week, Jim.
Thanks, John.
More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago-based biotech startup has had one of the largest funding rounds for a local company so far this year. Pathos AI raised $62 million in a Series C round. The cash haul brings its valuation to $600 million. Pathos AI is a clinical stage biotech company focused on re-engineering drug development through artificial intelligence. It has raised $102 million in 3 years and says this latest funding will help expand its team. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now a look at the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and let's begin with presidential candidate Donald Trump speaking in Chicago recently.
To me, the most beautiful word in the dictionary is tariff.
And that has a lot of people in agriculture worried, as we will hear after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, the prospect of another tariff war if Donald Trump is elected president has many people in agriculture concerned because farm products from corn and soybeans to apples are low-hanging fruit for retribution by other countries and could cost U.S. soybean farmers billions of dollars.
And we would also see a lot of the production up here in the U.S. go down to South America.
That's Scott Gerlt, the chief economist at the American Soybean Association.
And that's a long-term consequence as well. Even when a trade war ends, we saw last time around.
And agriculture is an innocent bystander in the tariff wars. The last time then-President Trump imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, the Chinese responded by imposing a 35% tariff on U.S. soybeans.
In China, at one point, it stopped even buying U.S. soybeans altogether.
He says China still has that 35% tariff on soybeans, but is not enforcing it. If it resumed,
soybean prices would drop by about 60 cents a bushel. We also found corn prices would drop about 8 cents a bushel, about $5 billion a year.
And if China responded with a 60% tariff, which is a number Mr. Trump has floated?
That would be about a dollar per bushel price drop with soy, which is right now about 10%.
There's plenty of deja vu here. 75% of our soybean exports went away. Billions of dollars in sales were lost because of the Trump tariffs and still are not back to what they were before. But farmers got checks from the government to make up for the tariff damage, totaling $28 billion.
They did. And the problem is, though, is that that aid is temporary.
And in Brazil, which China turned to for soybeans.
Once land goes into production in Brazil, once they convert land, it's going to stay in cropland.
Scott Gerlt, chief economist of the American Soybean Association, and a spokeswoman points out that the association is not choosing a side in the election. It is nonpartisan. On the food calendar, today is National Candy Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Michael Edwards is the president and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance. They check in now and then to tell us what the loop business and foot traffic is like. Welcome back, Michael. How are you?
Great. How are you?
Real good. Okay, three quarters of the year in, right? October is over. So you've got, I guess, do these numbers include October?
Yeah, these are, July, August, and September. So prime downtown months for us.
And how did we do in the city?
We did great. You could argue that the downtown is in a period of renaissance, and we're really excited about that because of the consistent growth in pedestrian traffic, number of people coming back to work since the pandemic.
How do you track this?
Well, we do pedestrian counts up and down State Street. And so, for example, 1.6 million people were on State Street on a weekly basis throughout that third quarter, which is about 84% of what it would have been like the third quarter of 2019. So we're really happy about that. And then, you know, the way people get here, public transit is increasingly becoming safer, more consistent, more reliable for people. And so we saw a 14% increase in that to some of the highest levels since 2019.
Physically, how do you count pedestrians?
We have counters on the parapet of about 9 intersections that put a line, an electrical line across the street from way above, and then they count people as they walk past that counting line. And we're just counting bodies. We're not really counting people. There's no cameras. These are just counters.
Hmm. So you're throwing an electrical, not electrical, but some sort of beam is invisibly past.
That's better. Yes, John, that's people, a much better description.
Sure, and people break that beam, it counts.
Right. Right, and it recognizes the human form, and so if there's 4 of you walking together, it'll count 4 people.
About that. And was this technology in place before the pandemic started?
Yes, thank goodness. Yes, we put it up in 2015, and it was useful. We could give counts to brokers and realtors, but it really became powerful once we could start to compare pre-pandemic to the current situation, and we're pleased with how things are going. July, August, and September, those are prime months. Tons of stuff going on downtown. It is Chicagoland's front yard. And so between Lollapalooza and NASCAR and Sueños Festival and El Grito, it's just a great place for everybody to come and celebrate being in Chicago.
Yeah, no kidding. So you mentioned State Street. Are you sort of extrapolating from State Street the whole downtown, or do you monitor other streets as well?
We monitor a little bit on Michigan Avenue by the museum, the art museum, and up near the corner by the river. We track those, but there's not enough information for them to be very reliable for us. But it does give us a sense of what are the busy corners on Michigan Avenue. We'd love to have more counters.
Well, really, is that it? But you also make it sound like State Street would be the busiest pedestrian street. And by my observation, that's not the case. Is it, in fact, the busiest for pedestrians?
Well, that's a really good point you make. Is it the busiest street? I don't think so, although it's a pretty busy street. And it's really not the numbers so much, John, that we're interested in. It's the trend.
Yeah.
And so if we're 84% of activity on State Street compared to before the pandemic, pretty much that's probably what's going on around the rest of the loop.
So, right. So 1.6 million is a nice number, but 84% is the most germane of them, isn't it?
Correct. You are absolutely correct.
What other things are you monitoring? Do you have office occupancy or ridership on the CTA?
Yeah, so ridership is up 14%. Metro is up 10%. Those are Q2 numbers. They're always a little bit behind in terms of reporting. But that demonstrates some confidence in the public transit systems. Hotels are still below pandemic levels, but they're pretty close. They're within 7% of pre-pandemic levels in terms of hotel occupancy for those 3 months. Arts and culture, 841,000 people came down to go to arts and culture and museums here in the district. And that's generating $230 million of direct impact, not secondary impact, just direct impact. And so we're very pleased. It's where people come for culture and arts, and we're very pleased about that. It's kind of the Loop secret sauce.
Yeah, how are you defining the Loop?
We define the Loop by the rivers on the north and west side, on Michigan Avenue, and then Ida B. Wells.
Okay, so the Chicago River north, I get that. Then it makes that the South Branch.
Correct.
Down to, did you say Roosevelt? Down to where?
Down to Ida B. Wells.
Ida B. Wells, and then back over to Michigan Avenue and up.
Correct.
So not down to the lakefront, though. You are not including the museum campus then, huh?
No, not really. No, we don't. I mean, they're great partners of ours, and we love everybody going down there. And you can get a bus from the Loop to go down there. But no, we don't include those.
Sure. Well, you have your group, and you're monitoring that. But then also excluded is North Michigan Avenue, is the Gold Coast, is the Viagra
Correct.
Triangle. And I would hope then that whatever you all are experiencing here again, the trend is shared by those other areas.
I think that's true. I mean, we're not out of the woods. We have issues of perceived issues of crime. Office return to office is way slower than we would like it to be, and a bit behind some of our southern city competitors. But it seems to be getting better, and there seems to be more people on the trains, and people are coming back to work.
My experience has been I've been riding the L more lately than I usually do, and it's as crowded as it can be. It's not like where a train pulls up and I can't get on, but it's almost that sometimes, and that's weirdly a good sign. Talk about office occupancy. I mean, how important is that people are coming downtown, and where are you on that?
Right. So it's very important. We're at about 52%, which is way lower than we would like. But compared to other cities around the country, we're only behind Austin and Houston and Dallas, which are southern cities that really never closed down. So we're very pleased with where we're at. We need to get better. Some of our buildings are beginning to trade, and some of the office buildings are beginning to trade. And so we do think there will be continued movement, and maybe some lease rates will come down a little bit, keep people in these buildings. The office buildings along the lake at Wacker and West Wacker along the lake are performing at a higher level than the ones internal to the Loop, because they're a bit newer, they have more amenities, they're on the river. There may be a little bit easier access from all of the trains, but they're doing pretty well, 96% occupancy.
It's an encouraging report at loopchicago.com, loopchicago.com. Michael Edwards is the president and CEO of the Chicago Loop Alliance. Keep us posted, Michael.
Will do. Thank you, John.